From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the Cole Porter of the Muppet world, composer Jeff Moss joins us at the piano to play some favorites like Rubber Ducky and I Love Trash. He's written songs for Sesame Street since the show premiered. He co-created Cookie Monster and Oscar the Grouch. And Pauline Kael reflects on 30 years of film criticism. She retired from The New Yorker 3 years ago. Now she has a new book called For Keeps that collects her film reviews from her entire career. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. United Nations Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali is warning of a possible UN pullout from Bosnia if the government and rebel Serbs do not cooperate with the UN. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports from Zagreb, Croatia.
Boutros-Ghali went to Sarajevo to secure a ceasefire around Bihać and an end to the detention of UN troops by Bosnian Serbs. While demonstrators protested what they called the UN's betrayal of Bosnian Muslims, Boutros-Ghali met with President Alija Izetbegovic. But he failed to see Bosnian Serbs, who refused to meet him at the airport. The Secretary General said that Serb leader Radovan Karadzic had thus done his people a great disservice. On leaving, Boutros-Ghali said that unless both sides are willing to negotiate and cooperate with the UN, he could be forced to pull out the 23,000 UN troops from Bosnia. Pentagon officials say that tens of thousands of troops would be needed for such an operation. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Zagreb.
A Navy spokesman says American helicopters have taken food, water, and medicine to hundreds of passengers and crew rescued from the burning cruise liner Achille Lauro. Nearly 1,000 people, including 10 Americans, got off the ship safely into lifeboats and were picked up by merchant ships. And the Navy says the helicopters will make several more supply runs. The ship's owners say two people have been killed, one by a heart attack and the other by a head injury. The Italian cruise ship is reported fully engulfed in flames off the coast of Somalia. The cause of the fire is not known. The Achille Lauro is the same cruise ship that was hijacked in 1985 by Palestinian terrorists who killed an American passenger, Leon Klinghoffer. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund reports that creation of heavily black congressional districts did not hurt Democratic candidates in the recent midterm elections. The civil rights group says any suggestion the Voting Rights Act increased the Democratic losses is false and pernicious. NPR's John Greenberg reports.
Some Democratic analysts have speculated that redistricting in 1991 to give minorities a better chance of being elected took votes away from Democratic incumbents. Eric Schnapper, a senior analyst with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, says the numbers debunk that theory. The Democrats' problem, he says, was the massive loss of white voter support.
If you have a district in which you take 10,000 black voters out of it, and then 50,000 white voters switch to the Republican Party, and you say, was taking the black voters out a factor? The answer is no. It's like someone took away, you know, a couple sandbags in front of your house and then a 30-foot tidal wave came along.
The civil rights group says if the Voting Rights Act had not been in place, Democratic losses would have been even higher. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 5 points. The Nasdaq Composite Index is down nearly 2 points. This is NPR. House Democrats have elected Missouri Congressman Richard Gephardt to be minority leader in the new congressional session starting in January. Gephardt, the current majority leader, defeated Congressman Charlie Rose of North Carolina by a vote of 150-58. Sources say the Democrats have reelected Congressman Vic Fazio of California as party caucus chairman over Congressman Kwesi Mfume of Maryland. Congress has let the health insurance tax deduction for self-employed Americans expire. That means millions of the self-employed will have to wait until at least next year to get their tax break restored. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The 25% tax deduction for health premiums paid by the self-employed expired at the end of 1993. Several major health reform bills, including President Clinton's plan, would have restored and expanded it to as much as 100%. But when health reform died, the self-employed were left without the deduction. Lawmakers in both parties say they want to restore the tax break, but it wasn't on the agenda for the lame duck Congress that returned to Washington yesterday to vote on GATT. The new Republican-led Congress is likely to restore the tax break retroactively next year, but unless it acts before April 15, 1995, millions of self-employed Americans would have to file their 1994 tax returns without the deduction. If it were restored after that date, they would have to file the amended returns to take advantage of it. For someone in the 28% tax bracket, the tax deduction saves $280 for every $1,000 paid in health premiums. For someone in the lower tax bracket of 15%, it saves $150. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
The Chicago Tribune reports today about a dozen pilots for the American Eagle airline are refusing to fly in cold, rainy weather. Those are the conditions under which an American Eagle ATR-72 turboprop crashed in Indiana last month, killing everyone on board. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cole Porter wrote songs for Ethel Merman. My guest Jeff Moss writes for Miss Piggy, Oscar the Grouch, and Cookie Monster. Unlike Ethel Merman, Miss Piggy is never gracious enough to credit her songwriter, but we'll give him his due today. Jeff Moss has been a songwriter for Sesame Street since the show premiered about 26 years ago. He's also served as the show's head writer. The songs he wrote for the film The Muppets Take Manhattan earned him an Oscar nomination. His best-known song, Rubber Ducky, was a top 40 hit. Recently, Jeff Moss has been writing children's books. His new one is called Hieronymus White, A Bird Who Believed That He Always Was Right. It's always fun to hear composers sing their own songs, so we invited Jeff Moss to join us in our studio at the piano and sing some of the songs he wrote which made the Muppets stars. Jeff Moss, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Why don't we start with the song that's your chart buster? It actually made it to, I think, number 16 on the Billboard chart.
Something like that, back a few years ago. The highest on the charts ever, I think, for a song sung by a guy in a bathtub. A rubber ducky, you're the one. You make bath time lots of fun. Rubber ducky, I'm awfully fond of you. Vovodio, rubber ducky, joy of joys. When I squeeze you, you make noise. Rubber ducky, you're my very best friend, it's true. Oh, every day when I make my way to the tubby, I find a little fellow who's cute and yellow and chubby. Rub-a-dub-dubby, rubber ducky, you're so fine. And I'm lucky that you're mine. Rubber ducky, I'm awfully fond of. Rubber ducky, I'd like a whole pond of. Rubber ducky, I'm awfully fond of you.
Great. I should have been squeezing it in the background, right?
In fact, it was I who was squeezing it in the background
on
those
record.
Many years ago on the record, yeah.
So how did you write the song?
Well, depending which story I tell, either it was very late at night and I was there alone in my tub with my rubber duck just overcome with the poetry of the song, or I had created a character of the rubber duck for Ernie, and it was just, he loved it. It was his passion, his obsession, and it just overflowed that way.
And Jeff Moss, you were one of the original writers on Sesame Street. When you signed on to do the show, was it understood you'd be writing songs, too, and that songs would be an important part of the program?
In fact, we thought that songs might be an important part of the program, but no. Joe Raposo was the original music director, and we found out we were going to use records, and we found out because it was public television, it was very hard to clear the rights to use them. So Joe came to me and said, well, look, you write words and music, I write words and music, why don't we just do it? We'll write to the curriculum, we'll do it faster. Joe was wonderfully ebullient. He said, we'll do it better, let's just go do it, and we did it.
Were you already writing songs? Did you have confidence you could do this?
Oh, sure.
What kind of songs had you been writing?
Well, from the time I was 9 or 10, I'd been writing songs to, entertain my friends. And then in college, I'd written the musical comedy stuff in college. And then my first job, which had been at another children's television show called Captain Kangaroo, I'd written a lot of songs for there.
Huh. So now you were also in on the creation of some of the characters,
mm-hmm.
like Cookie Monster.
Indeed.
And Oscar.
Indeed.
Tell us about creating Cookie Monster.
Well, Cookie Monster, Jim and his people had created the physical monsters before Sesame Street, but they had always been quite scary, and they never spoke. But they were just such wonderful puppets that I went into somebody's office one day and said, well, how about that furry blue one with the boggly eyes? Could he maybe talk? And they said, well, you know, the puppeteers don't talk very much, and they're scary. And so I said, well, what if he doesn't talk very much, and I try to make him funny? And they said, well, go ahead and do it. And I wrote a bit for him in which he had two words, and one of them was milk, and the other one was cookie. And we were in the studio, and Frank Oz performed them just so brilliantly, we all fell off the seats, and I went back and started writing more.
Oh, I think this is a song cue. Why don't you do a Cookie Monster song?
Yeah, this is what he has for breakfast, for lunch, for dinner, but he sings about breakfast today. He says, me have a soft boiled cookie with a glass of cookie juice on the side, or for a change one morning me will have me cookie scrambled or fried. It isn't hard each morning to keep me satisfied. Just give me a soft boiled cookie, please, with a glass of cookie juice on the side.
That's great. So was the voice your idea or Frank Oz's idea?
Oh, no, That's a poor imitation of Frank Oz, whose idea it was.
Mm-hmm. Now you co-created Oscar.
Co-created Oscar, yeah.
And how did he come about?
He came about because the educators had suggested that we have a character who showed kids that it wasn't necessary to be cheerful all the time. So a grouch was created, and it was decided that he lived in a trash can, and then we sat down and kind of created this wonderful vicious circle for him where if you make him happy, he hates that, and that makes him unhappy, but being unhappy makes him happy, so he likes that, but that makes him unhappy, etc., etc., etc. Meanwhile, he has his obsession and his passion, which is Oscar sings,
oh, I love trash. Anything dirty or dingy or dusty. Anything ragged or rotten or rusty. Oh, I love trash.
I like the idea that you put that in waltz time.
Yes, indeed. It was a good juxtaposition of trying to write a pretty waltz for a yucky character.
Did educators ever object to the fact that he was an unsanitary puppet?
Do you know, they didn't. But we think that today, if we were creating today, they might have. You know, they might have worried that kids would crawl in garbage cans and all that. But they never did. So the writers feel that the kids can discriminate. The educators test it out. We don't.
When you were younger, you had ambitions of writing Broadway musicals?
Well, in fact, I probably did, yeah. I grew up, I guess, during the late 50s, and I can remember, my father was on the stage. My father was an actor, and I can remember.
Really? Would I know him?
Arnold Moss, his name was, and he was a Shakespearean actor. And my earliest memories are theater memories, and I can remember The King and I and that kind of stuff. But by the time I was old enough to try it, it kind of was going in a different direction than it had been going, and I found Sesame Street, and that's the direction everything went.
Broadway, I imagine, was going in the ersatz rock direction?
It was going in rock, and it was going in the area where the songs were less important, where the production was much more important, and Bob Fosse's and Tommy Toon's and those people who were brilliant, but they were the stars. They were the people who were using, you know, the Gershwin songs rather than the new writers' songs.
Now, you got to write a Broadway musical in the sense that you wrote the songs for The Muppets Take Manhattan,
mm-hmm.
which is about
Absolutely.
The Muppets going to Manhattan to do
a Broadway
show.
Yes, at the Biltmore Theater.
So did you get a chance to write the kinds of songs for that were very close to what you would have written for the stage?
I don't think so. They were more the kinds of songs that I would have written if I had been doing the Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland movies
right.
of the 30s, which is another way that one might look at Kermit and Piggy. And the show that they put on was a very glitzy Broadway show. But there was jazz in that score that I wrote. There was rock, and there was waltzes again, and kind of ragtime.
We got an Academy Award nomination for the songs that you wrote for The Muppets Take Manhattan. Let me ask you to do one of the songs from there. It's a song you wrote for Miss Piggy about how she wants to be a movie star.
Yeah, she wanted to be everything and love her man at the same time. She said, I want to be a movie star, and I want to learn to drive a car. I want to be a veterinarian too, and I'm gonna always love you. And then she sang, I'll be the cutest model you ever saw, and then I think I'll study criminal law. And I'm gonna learn to scuba dive too, and I'm gonna always love you. Went on, and she wanted to climb the Matterhorn, but only after all her children were born. And she wanted to be a good mommy, too, but I want to always love you.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeff Moss, and he's been writing for Sesame Street ever since the show began. He's written many of the sketches and many, many of the songs. And he also writes books for children now, and his latest is called Aronimus White. You must have been really shocked when Jim Henson died so suddenly a few years ago.
It was awful. It was totally unexpected and as devastating as any death has been to me. I got a call from a friend of mine at 3 o'clock in the morning who said, sit down, and it's the only call. We stayed on the phone till 4 o'clock in the morning, and then I went back to bed and just didn't want to get up. Felt that if I didn't read it in the paper or didn't hear it on the radio or the TV, then it wouldn't have happened. It was a terrible loss, and it shouldn't have happened. I mean, it was, if he had been in the hospital 12 hours earlier, they would have given him penicillin and he would have been fine.
He had a bacterial infection. Was he working through that, working while he was sick?
But he was sick for 48 hours. I mean, it wasn't that he had such a phenomenal endurance that what would have sent anybody but him to the hospital to find out what was wrong, he probably just said, oh, gee, I'm feeling tired. I mean, he didn't need very much sleep. He had endless energy and was not, he was sick for a long weekend. That's all he was sick.
What happened on the show afterwards? Did you all stop working for a while?
The show, as I remember, we were not in production at the time, so I think it was the spring that he died, and we were not in production then. And just only now have new Kermit pieces begun to be done, as somebody else does Kermit, and we're seeing if we may do a few Ernie and Bert bits.
So you had thought the characters would be retired.
Well, they were retired in the sense of doing new material, but there's a library of 20-something years of them, so an average Sesame Street new show, maybe 50% of the material is new and 50% of it is from 22 years, and most of the stuff that Jim did is so classic that you wouldn't know whether it was year 3 or year 23, so the show has not felt his the lack of his presence the same way life has. Life has felt the lack of his presence.
My guest is Sesame Street songwriter Jeff Moss. He also writes children's books. His latest is called Hieronymus White, A Bird Who Believed That He Always Was Right. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jeff Moss, one of the writers on Sesame Street, writers of sketches and songs, and also he writes books. His latest is called Hieronymus White. Now, your first job after college, I think, was working on Captain Kangaroo as a
production
assistant.
Assistant.
What was the job description?
There was no job description. The woman who hired me said, well, we have jobs for production assistant. You could choose either the CBS News or Captain Kangaroo, and I was being very young and flip, and I said, well, I've seen the news. And I hadn't seen Kangaroo, and that's where I ended up.
So you didn't grow up watching Captain Kangaroo? No. I'll confess, I never liked the show when I was growing up. I couldn't understand the attraction of what seemed to me to be an old man wearing overalls. and it was such a non-urban show to me that I just never related to
it. Well, it wasn't non-urban, though it did have a moose who liked to drop ping pong balls on people's heads, which was not urban, but neither was it particularly rural. But it's funny. It had a lot of funny stuff in it and a lot of educational stuff that I guess maybe we didn't realize or the people who made the show didn't realize that it had. And I did that for 6 months and then came back as a writer for a couple of years, and it was a very nice place to begin.
So when you got the job on Sesame Street, were there things you felt you wanted to do different than the way you'd seen it done on Captain Kangaroo?
Everything about Sesame Street was new. The great thing was that we had a marvelous freedom that we didn't realize we had then. This is looking back on it, but Joan Cooney had raised a lot of money that couldn't be paid to anyone in salaries but could be spent on production. And we didn't have a network that we had to please. We didn't have stars that we had to please. We didn't have sponsors that we had to please. And we were committed to doing 130 hours of television. And there were four of us wrote 90% of the first year's show. And we could just have the most wonderful time as long as we were willing to work 37 hours a day. And we just did whatever we wanted to do that stuck to the curriculum. In the early years when I was head writer, I used to say to the writers, look, the two jobs you have is one to keep the 3 to 5-year-old watching the TV, and the other one is to write a show that if you were spinning the dial, you would stop and watch yourself. And that's what we did creatively from the very, very beginning.
Was every song supposed to carry a lesson with it?
Yes, and almost every song did, and almost every piece of material on Sesame Street did and does.
Do you have a song that's your favorite lyric for teaching something in a really entertaining way?
Of the recent songs that I've done, we began doing racial relations as a goal a few years ago, just several years ago, and they wanted a song that would kind of be the corner post of that. It's a film of kids at the beach, kids playing at the beach in their bathing suits, and this is the way I chose to deal with it. Skin covered all over with beautiful skin. Skin covered all over from ankle to chin. Lovely skin on knees and noses and everywhere. Skin on tummies and toeses and under your hair, it's even there. Oh, skin, wonderful colors and beautiful tones. Skin, think of without it, you're nothing but bones. Skin is ever so lovely no matter the color you're in. Let's hear it for skin. Beautiful skin, let's hear it for skin. Beautiful skin.
No, who sings that on the show?
It's the voice of Kevin Clash, who's one of the Muppets, but it's just a film of the kids playing at the beach. It's not a Muppet song.
That's a good song. Your little Tin Pan Alley numbers.
Yeah.
Well, you've been writing more books lately, focusing more on the books.
The last 5 years, yeah, I've done more writing of the books than I have of anything else.
Why is that?
I was asked, probably 6 or 7 years ago, Marlo Thomas was putting together a book about families, and they asked me to do something, and what I ended up doing was a long poem, and they liked it, and it was very successful. And the next time I had free time on my schedule, I began writing poems, and when I had 10 or 20, I told my wife that was what I was doing, and I had 90 or 100, and I said, well, gee, this might be a book. But before then, because I hadn't raised children, I had not been into the bookstores to see what was out there, and I've been very fortunate. The first book was The Butterfly Jar, which is still out there and just in its 11th or 12th printing now.
And your new book is called Aronimus White. Tell us a little bit about the story, and then I want you to read the beginning of it.
Yeah, Hieronymus White, it's subtitled A Bird Who Believed That He Always Was Right, and it's about a bird who comes to believe that he always was right. It begins goes back to way before he was born, when his parents are very young, and goes through to the point that his granddaughter has grown up, and it shows the good things about believing you're always right and the bad things, and it traces his life and comes to a point where something happens that causes him to no longer believe that he's always right. This is the story of Hieronymus White, a bird who believed that he always was right. He was always an expert, whatever the task. He would share his advice. There was no need to ask. When his children came down with a fever or chills, he'd order the doctor to choose different pills. When the postman delivered a package or letter, Hieronymus told him how he could do better. He approached every issue so confidently, he'd seem shocked at the thought that you might not agree. Yes, all through a life that was famous and long, Hieronymus thought that he couldn't be wrong, till one day late in life when his feathers were thinning. So now let's go back to the very beginning. This is the story of Hieronymus White, a bird who believed that he always was right.
I really like that. I'm sure I know this character.
Yes, I think we all do.
This character has given me too much advice over the years. So what inspired you to write this story?
I think I wanted to write, firstly, about a person who believed that he always was right. I have known a number of them in my life, and sometime don't have to go too much farther than the mirror to find one. And also I wanted to write about continuity and about passing things on from one generation to the next. And I began the story, and it kind of took off and became what it became.
Let me get you to do a short grumpy poem from a previous collection of poems called The Butterfly Jar.
This is called Hi, How Are You Today? I'm feeling very horrible and low and mean and mad and dreadful and deplorable and rotten, sick and sad and nasty and unbearable and hateful, vile and blue. But thanks a lot for asking, and please tell me, how are you?
Very good. Well, it's really been a pleasure.
Me too.
Having you here on the show, I've really enjoyed it a lot. I'd love for you to end with a song, and you have actually a very sweet song about goodbyes. Maybe you can do that. Tell us first how you wrote it.
It's from The Muppets Take Manhattan, and it comes at a time when the Muppets are not being successful in their quest to become stars on Broadway, so they all have to split up and go in their various directions, and this is the song they sing. Saying goodbye, going away, seems like goodbye's such a hard thing to say. Touching a hand, wondering why, it's time for saying goodbye. Saying goodbye, why is it sad? Makes us remember the good times we've had. Much more to say, foolish to try. It's time for saying goodbye. Don't want to leave, still we both know. Sometimes it's better to go. Somehow I know we'll meet again. Don't know just where, and I'm not sure just when. You're in my heart, so until then, want to smile, want to cry, saying goodbye.
Jeff Moss writes songs for Sesame Street. He also writes children's books. His new one is called Hieronymus White, A Bird Who Believed That He Always Was Right. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's been 3 years since film critic Pauline Kael left The New Yorker, and we miss her. Coming up, we catch up on what she's been thinking. Kael has a new book that collects the reviews she thinks represent the best work of her career. Her anthology is called For Keeps. Pauline Kael, coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. The UN Secretary General left Sarajevo today without commitments from either of the warring Bosnian parties to accept a ceasefire. The Bosnian Serbs wouldn't even meet with Boutros Boutros-Ghali at Sarajevo Airport, as the UN had requested. Muslim-led government officials refused to agree to a ceasefire unless the Serbs did first. Boutros-Ghali says if the warring factions don't agree to work with the UN peacekeepers, the UN force may be withdrawn. And if the peacekeepers are pulled out, the U.S. says it would help with the operation. UPI's Bill Small reports.
The bottom line, says Press Secretary D.D. Myers, is yes, the U.S. would help U.N. troops withdrawing from Bosnia under fire. But she says it's not an issue of immediate concern.
The president has not made a decision yet, one way or another, about how we would participate, what nature that participation would take. But I think protecting Allied troops under hostile circumstances is a particular situation and something that we are certainly committed to doing.
Myers says Mr. Clinton has not decided whether U.S. ground forces might be used in such a case, although she says they will not be used to try to change the military situation in Bosnia. Bill Small at the White House.
Passing ships have rescued nearly 1,000 passengers and crew from lifeboats after fire swept the cruise ship Achille Lauro. The Italian Coast Guard says two passengers have died, one from a heart attack and the other from a blow to the head suffered while boarding a lifeboat. The ocean liner is reported fully engulfed in flames off the coast of Somalia. The Achille Lauro is the same ship that was hijacked in 1985 by Palestinian terrorists who killed American passenger Leon Klinghoffer. Anti-abortion activist Paul Hill appeared before a Pensacola, Florida judge today in a pre-sentencing hearing. Hill could face the death penalty for the murders of an abortion doctor and his volunteer escort. Debbie Elliott reports.
Prosecutors told Judge Frank Bell that he should uphold the jury's recommendation that Hill be put to death for killing Dr. John Britton and James Barrett outside a Pensacola abortion clinic. Hill, who was representing himself, made a brief statement telling the judge that instead of pleading for his life, he would call on compassionate men to defend the unborn as they would born children. Hill believes that it's justified to kill abortion providers to save the unborn. Judge Bell will sentence Hill next Tuesday. He could impose death in Florida's electric chair or life in prison with no chance of parole. For National Public Radio, I'm Debbie Elliott in Pensacola, Florida.
The Supreme Court heard arguments today on whether the government can prevent beer companies from putting the alcohol content of their product on the label. The Justice Department argued that the ban prevents strength wars among the brewers, and the lawyer for the Adolph Coors Company said the ban is an unconstitutional restriction on commercial speech. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose a fraction of a point. This is NPR. Prison officials say the inmate, beaten at the same time as serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer, has also died. Dahmer died shortly after the attack in the Wisconsin prison. A third inmate is expected to be charged in the beating deaths of Dahmer and Jeffrey Anderson. Anderson died of his injuries today. He had been serving a life sentence for killing his wife. A powerful Pacific storm is sweeping across Washington state, with flooding reported from the Pacific coast to the Cascade Mountains. Some communities have received as much as 4 inches of rain in less than 8 hours. Steve Krueger of member station KPLU reports.
It's called a Pineapple Express, a fast-moving warm air mass that sweeps into the Pacific Northwest, bringing with it gale-force winds and warm rain. The snow level climbed from 1,500 feet to more than 12,000 feet in a matter of hours. That began some fast melting of the early winter snowpacks in the Olympic and Cascade Mountains. The runoff combined with heavy rain to cause flooding along the west coast of the Olympic Peninsula. The community of Moclips was cut off when local streams overflowed their banks and covered three highways and two bridges. No one's been hurt, but many families are stranded on high ground, surrounded by floodwaters. More problems are expected overnight in the mountains east of Seattle. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Krueger in Seattle.
The Postal Rate Commission has approved raising the cost of mailing a letter first class to 32 cents. The hike is expected to take effect in January. The commission also has voted to raise rates for second, third, and fourth class mail by 14%. The U.S. and South Korea agreed today that Seoul will take back control of its armed forces. The U.S. has held operational control over the South Korean and American forces stationed in South Korea since the war in the early 1950s. The transfer of control back to South Korea takes effect tomorrow. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's been something missing in the lives of many filmgoers ever since film critic Pauline Kael retired from The New Yorker magazine 3 years ago. She says she'd still be writing today if age and illness hadn't laid her low. Kael is 75, and Parkinson's disease has made it hard for her to get around. Kael reviewed movies from 1961 to 1991. Those reviews have been collected in about a dozen books, but most of them are out of print. Now Kael has a new anthology called For Keeps that collects about a fifth of the reviews from her entire career. Her reviews are more than consumer guides. You read them to compare notes with Kael, to agree or to argue with her, to see not just what she thinks, but how she thinks. I asked Pauline Kael how she's seen her role as a film critic.
I really tried to give what I thought was going on in the movies and how they reflected what was going on around us and how they falsified it. And there's a lot of falsification at work. I mean, the whole way that Sylvester Stallone has come to represent what people wish the Vietnam period had been. I mean, at first it seemed a joke when he kept winning in Vietnam for us. Now he represents a spirit of winning for the whole culture. And I guess Arnold Schwarzenegger does the same thing. But those movies are essentially meaningless to people except in making them feel that there's power in these bodies and that they can identify with that power. But they come out of the movie with not much. I mean, because they don't know whether to laugh at the guys or take them seriously.
In rereading your work, did you find that there were actors, directors, or writers whose careers turned out very differently from what you expected when you were reviewing their early work?
Almost all of them, because I could not have expected that things would go to hell after the Vietnam period, that the loosening up in movies and the whole personal expression that directors were giving to movies in the 70s would turn into dust in the 80s and early 90s. And it has. I mean, the great directors have not sustained their greatness. They've become much more conventional. The people who burst through in the 70s have lost their bearings. They don't know what to express in the movies anymore, or they've given up trying, or they've fought and lost. I mean, a few flops and they lose the right to try again, although Coppola goes on trying and trying and somehow seems to have less and less to say. But, I mean, look at someone like Scorsese, who in Taxi Driver and Mean Streets brought something really new into films. He's become technically more expert. He's become a fantastic technician. But when he makes something like Cape Fear, he seems to forget that the purpose of the thriller is to be entertaining. It works on ugliness and dread, and you hate it. You feel you've been through something shameful. It's as if the spirit has soured in movies. When you went to a Hitchcock thriller, he teased, it was entertaining, it was titillating. When you go to a thriller now, you expect to come out feeling terrible.
I want to read something that you wrote about Platoon and Oliver Stone, and I think of it now as almost prophetic. I remember when I saw Platoon, I quite liked the film, and I was really disappointed that you didn't, although I thought that you were probably right, that Stone was a little heavy-handed in portraying the Berenger and Defoe characters as the embodiment of pure good and pure evil. But let me read something you wrote in that review. You said Stone's movie making doesn't suggest that he was a young, idealistic Chris Taylor, that's the Charlie Sheen character, going to war to find himself in the comradeship of the anonymous, but rather that he was a romantic loner who sought his manhood in the excitement of violent fantasy. Stone seems to want to get high on war, like Barnes, which is the Berenger character. I guess reading that in the light of having seen Natural Born Killers.
He does want to get high on the violence, and then he wants to blame us for it.
Exactly.
It's the most treacherous of all movie makers' techniques, I think. It's the most hypocritical.
Why do you call it so hypocritical?
Because the violence is directed at people who are monsters, and so you really can't help being on the side of the young killers. Because everybody they kill deserves to die, and that includes just about everybody in the culture around you. Everybody is made a horror, older, fatter, grosser, nastier, vicious. And so you're put on the side of these reckless, ruthless young psychopaths.
Do you wish you could have written about Natural Born Killers?
I hated it so much that it would have been difficult. I feel I've written about Oliver Stone too much already. People think you have a phobia when you pick on the same director time after time. They don't realize that the same thing is coming out time after time.
I want to read something that you wrote about Mean Streets when that film came out. You wrote, though, the street language and the operatic style may be too much for those with conventional tastes. If this picture isn't a runaway success, the reason could be that it's so original, some people will be dumbfounded, too struck to respond. It's about American life here and now, and it doesn't look like an American movie or feel like one. If it were subtitled, we could hail a new European or South American talent, a new Buñuel steeped in Verdi, perhaps, and go home easier at heart. Because what Scorsese, who is 30, has done with the experience of growing up in New York's Little Italy has a thicker textured rot and violence than we have ever had in an American movie and a riper sense of evil. Did Scorsese ever contact you after you wrote that?
Well, he contacted me. I've forgotten when it was. He contacted me, I think, after Ellis doesn't live here anymore. He disagreed with something I had said in it. In the review, but we've had cordial relations over the years, very distant but cordial, even when I've been rather unhappy about his films, and I have been unhappy about any number of them. It seems to me that he wants a career as a conventional Hollywood Academy Award winning director, that he lost the confidence in the direction he was going in when he started. But he made a few films that will be landmarks in American movies forever, I think. And that's an awful lot to ask of anybody. I mean, we shouldn't say someone is a failure if after two or three great pieces he doesn't do any more up to that.
Is it hard for you when you've met a director or an actor and you like them as a person and you really admire, I mean, love some of the work that they've done, to then give a bad review?
Of course, it's painful, but it's almost worse to love somebody's work and find out you can't stand him, which often happens too. Directors are very commanding people. They're like generals of armies, and sometimes when you meet them surrounded by their pimps and sycophants, you're not too happy.
Pauline Kael is my guest, and she has a new anthology called For Keeps. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Pauline Kael, and she has a new collection that brings together pieces that she's written over the past, during her 30-year career of movie reviewing, and the new volume is called For Keeps. I'm interested in your thoughts on some current and recent films that you haven't gone on the record about in print. Pulp Fiction, have you had a chance to see it?
Yes, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. It's hugely entertaining. I laughed a lot. It's probably the most entertaining in the simple sense movie I've seen over the last year or two. It's just a very funny, fresh movie. I liked it a lot more than the earlier movie, Reservoir Dogs. It didn't depend as solely on sadism as that did. It's got very funny, absurdist dialogue. At the same time, I think people are taking it much too seriously when they write about it as if it were an advance in movie making. It's just an entertaining jolt.
I wonder what you think of John Travolta's performance in Pulp Fiction. And before you tell us, I thought I would quote something that you wrote about him from Saturday Night Fever. You wrote, John Travolta doesn't appear to be a natural dancer. His dances look like worked-up Broadway routines, but he gives himself to them with a fullness and zest that make his being the teenager's king utterly convincing. He commands the dance space at the Odyssey, and when the other dancers fall back to watch him, it's because he's joyous to watch. He acts like someone who loves to dance, and more than that, he acts like someone who loves to act.
I'd still stick with that. I think he's a wonderful actor. He gave perhaps his best performance in a film that very few people saw called Blowout. And I think it was a difficult, dark film, and people just didn't respond to it. The press didn't lead people to want to see it, and the advertising was very hesitant about it. And in recent years, he's come a cropper with some popular films, but films that haven't done anything for his reputation. He's awfully good in the Tarantino film.
Did you ever feel like he was going to never fulfill his promise again?
No, I didn't, because he's still very young. And that kind of talent emerges. I mean, we shouldn't think that people who don't succeed by the time they're 35 or even 45 are to be written off. I mean, there are a lot of second acts in American lives, Fitzgerald notwithstanding.
Well, but even you, I mean, you started your career as a film critic when you were, what, in your late 30s or early 40s, I think.
Well, I didn't actually write for big popular magazines till I was almost 50. So there's one example. And I think most people have probably written me off as a writer by that time. I published, I think, 13 or 14 books from my late 40s to now. So I got a very, very late start. And there are actors who don't come into their own until late. There are actors who were terrible early in their lives. I mean, Tony Curtis was a vile actor until Sweet Smell of Success and Trapeze and a few things when his career seemed to be almost finished. And it's often true that you don't see how good somebody is until later. I think Bruce Willis is a case in point. He seems so silly on his TV show that it's hard to acknowledge how good he is, not just in movies like Pulp Fiction, but in Death Becomes Her, and in the action films he does. He's a really talented man.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Pauline Kael, and she has a new anthology that collects film reviews she wrote through her career. It's called For Keeps, 30 Years at the Movies. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Right.
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what do you have on the political maneuvering behind the scenes of the Bosnian War?
Hi, Terry. Tom Jelton reports from Sarajevo. UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali went there, but neither side wanted to talk with him. Trevor Rowe reports from the UN in New York about the quandary of the UN peacekeeping mission, especially in Bosnia. Postal rates are going up by the 1st of January by 3 cents. Melinda Penkava has that story. Joe Palka reports that a gene has been found that could play an important role in determining how fat people turn out to be. And I'll talk with the author of a new biography of Louis Moreau Gottschalk, a New Orleans-born composer. And the book is called Bambula.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Back with Pauline Kael, who's joining us by phone. She has a new collection called For Keeps. I remember the last time we spoke about, I guess it was about 3 years ago when you retired from The New Yorker, we were talking about taste and how taste can either make a relationship or come between two people who might have thought of themselves as otherwise being in love. And to As a matter of fact, let me just read a short excerpt here. This is from your review of Dances with Wolves. You write, "A friend of mine broke up with his woman friend after they went to see Field of Dreams. She liked it. As soon as I got home from Dances with Wolves, I ran to the phone and warned him not to go to it with his new woman friend." And I remember, you know, the last time we spoke, you said you were even thinking about writing an article about taste, and if memory serves, you were going to write about how it affects people who are out on dates with each other, and how, like, the movie choices affect the power in the relationship, who makes the choice, and then who decides if it's a good movie. Are there people in your life where you don't want to know what their taste is so that it doesn't interfere with how you feel about them? Like if you have a doctor or something, do you want to know if he likes Dances with Wolves or not?
No. Well, let's put it this way. I want to know, but I don't want to have to talk about it.
But you don't want to choose your doctor about whether, you know, you don't want to choose your doctor based on your evaluation of
no,
his film taste.
No, I don't expect doctors to know much about movies. Presumably, they're too busy to go to them that much. But there are fields in which it's astounding to find out what people like, and it's a little depressing. It would be hard to date, I think, if you were a young woman. It'd be hard to date somebody who loved Dances with Wolves. But I wrote about that early when I wrote about someone who adored West Side Story. And I think it's always a problem for a young woman in particular dating, but men I know have problems. I know a young man who was very upset because his girlfriend didn't respond to McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and he felt it was hopeless to be with someone who didn't respond to that particular movie.
Well, do you think these strong feelings that you have about films and your kind of stupefaction when somebody likes a movie that you think is really dreadful, do you think that's ever interfered with relationships in your life?
Sure. It definitely has, because it enters into so many other areas. I mean, even a piece of music, Dido and Aeneas, was a turning point in my life when I discovered that the husband who'd bought me the recording of it that I wanted actually hated it.
And did that affect your feelings about him?
It sure did. I had thought that we saw eye to eye because he had bought it for me, and I assumed he adored it. Now, those can be terrible revelations.
Did you ever meet anybody who you truly saw eye to eye with?
No, but I meet people who were close enough, who are close enough to me, so that it doesn't make no never mind. I mean, small variations you can accept, but it would be painful, I think, to be living with someone and be unable to express your enthusiasm for certain works because they didn't share them.
How's your health now?
Well, I'm functioning. I don't function very well outside of the house. I mean, I'm very shaky on the street and terrible on stairs, and I take falls very easily. The repercussions are not easy. I'm miserable afterward. But no, I'm not in great shape.
Do you have someone living with you to take care of you?
No, blessedly I can manage by myself, which I love. I love the freedom and independence of living alone. It's marvelous. It's one of life's great privileges. I see people all the time, and I have a daughter and grandson in the area. And so I see them almost every day, but I love living alone.
Have you loved living alone for a long time?
Well, I haven't done it that much of my life, and I can stand it now. It's wonderful to be able to read when you want to and not be interrupted. It's wonderful to be able to read in bed at night and not worry about the light disturbing somebody. I mean, there's just a kind of freedom about it that you feel you've earned with old age.
I know you're very close with your daughter. How close is your taste in movies?
Oh, it's widely divergent. There was a period when it was closer, but I think it's quite far apart now.
And why do you think it's gotten further apart?
Well, she's more grown up.
Yeah.
And I think people's tastes in a family, if they got too close together, it would be ghastly. It would be incestuous. No, she's a very independent person, and she sees things very differently from the way I do.
Now, does it ever upset you when she likes a movie that you detest it?
It upsets me momentarily, and then it rather pleases me that she is that independent, because I would hate to have spawned a daughter who felt she needed to agree with me. My grandson's disagreements amuse me more, because he's 12, and he's centered on the period when Speed seems to him the greatest movie around for a while. I mean, he loves action movies, and he loves Bruce Lee, and anything with a lot of fighting. And I often share experiences with him, see things with him, and I see them through his eyes, and it's fun seeing them that way. But he thinks I'm a dope. I mean, he hits his head and says, duh, when we talk about a movie together.
Well, all the newspapers now rate for sex and violence so parents can keep their kids away from those films. Do you, as a grandparent, ever get concerned about what your nephew is getting exposed to on television or in movies?
My grandson.
Grandson, I'm sorry. That's what I meant to say.
I think he can take most things, but my daughter enforces certain bans. She doesn't like him to see our movies, and so we're rather careful about that. I'm a cautious grandmother in the sense that I don't want to interfere with the mother's policies. But I think he can handle most things, and he loves them. Even when they frighten him, when he sees them, thinking back on them months later, he likes them better.
Pauline Kael, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Pauline Kael has a new anthology called For Keeps, 30 Years at the Movies. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Bob Alls. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sienna Chrisman is our intern. And today we have the great pleasure of adding a new name to our illustrious roster. We welcome our new associate producer, Alan Tu. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The AIDS epidemic has inspired some extraordinary writing. We'll hear some of it on the next Fresh Air as we commemorate World AIDS Day. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.